Roy Clark is coming up right now. What I would ask you to do is, Roy was calling in from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this was recorded because of the timing of what, the way we needed to do it to fit his schedule. And sometimes that happens, and I always bow to what the artist wants to do. And it's a good recording. There are parts where the it's a little hard to hear because of the connection. But here's what I would suggest to you. Turn it up. And then get real close to the speakers and then just listen, like, close your eyes and, like, pretend that Roy is right there next to you. Not so much me, because that might creep you out, but it's a good interview. We've broken it into two parts, and then I will come in after the first part. And right, you'll get the point as to why it's been broken in half, and then we'll play the second part. You're going to like this. So thankful to Roy Clark and his people for being available. I had a blast. You're going to be able to know that by listening to me, that it was just like I was in a candy store, and I just couldn't keep focused, and we just kept bouncing around, but Roy was very steady as we go from beginning to where he is right now, more or less. So this will be part one of Roy Clark on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. I am very, very happy today to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass. I don't know how you categorize this fella as far as comparables. I don't know how you say there's somebody comparable to someone when there really isn't. You talk about someone that does everything and did everything and still does everything, and I have on the phone with me Roy Clark. I could not be more happy to have Roy Clark on the phone.
Well, it's definitely a pleasure to be here, but don't load me up with too much stuff. you have to come back and live with that.
Oh, listen, I was thinking through this today, and I thought, my goodness, of all the firsts, just in my life that you have, all the things that you've done just wall to wall. I mean, you could put your accomplishments, but for me, the things that you've introduced me as a fan to, the different kinds of music, the classical music, the bluegrass music, just the guitar, the singing, you've done so many things that, thinking back, sometimes it just kind of must make you feel a little bit bursting at the seams. You have to.
Well, it does get very personal. But I never had a route or that I was aiming for any one particular thing other than just to have fun, to enjoy it. When music no longer is fun, then you best go out and do something else. And also, music will get you out of a lot of tough places. That if it wasn't for music, you'd still be serving time. But I've been so blessed in my life. So my dad played, and in fact, I didn't know until I was older that my mother played piano.
No kidding.
And when I caught her playing piano one day, the first time I did, I said, I didn't know you played piano. She said, girls my age had to. That was an automatic have to. I guess the piano teachers would go around door to door, signing up the young people to learn how to play a piano.
Well, that's
from birth, I was covered with it.
It's interesting. We were talking off the air just a little bit about my own personal family band experience with my my great grandmother. I mentioned to you that I do want to talk about Kenny Price just briefly as we go through this. But Kenny Price is local, right across the road here, so to speak, the border of the counties. But my great grandmother also played keyboards. Now she had one in her home. She had a stop organ, if you remember those things, and. There was, other than the party line after the work was done, there was no other entertainment. Everybody got their instruments out and sat around and played.
Oh, it was. And they'd seek you out. If you played any kind of music, it wouldn't be too long. A neighbor will be knocking on the door and say, I wish you would invite me in. I've been listening to you. And the whole neighborhood area starts playing. It's just incredible the way that... what music can do for you.
It's just magic. It's magic stuff. And like you said, you did it clearly. You were successful at it, but also you loved it and it was fun. You clearly on stage, Roy Clark enjoys being on stage and performing and entertaining people. That's just an obvious thing. You mentioned your father playing, and you started playing much younger. I will say this. I didn't realize that you were as accomplished as you were at such an early age. I knew from television, but you were a banjo player, guitar player, all kinds of award. How did you get into that level of playing?
Well, I started playing around Washington, D.C. That's where I was raised in my teen years. And back then, I don't know how it could be the same today, but back then it seemed like on every street corner there was a good guitar player. And they came from down south. They'd come up to work for the federal government. And then you'd have young ladies just graduating high school and going to work for the government. And young service people, because there's about five or six big service bases in that immediate area. So you had the young girls, the young boys, and good guitar players. So it made for every night is like a big party.
Well, did you? Of course, I know you played a lot of different instruments, not just guitar and banjo that I'm most familiar with. But what was the first thing that really struck you that something you wanted to play? Was it guitar?
The first thing I wanted to learn to play?
Yes, sir.
Was the guitar.
Okay.
My dad played, he played everything, but he also concentrated on the tenor banjo.
Oh, yeah, now that's...
string banjo.
Yeah, see, now that's something that was in my family band. It's funny, I don't mean to talk about me so much, but when you mentioned that, there was one that hung in the basement of my grandpa's house above the rafters, and that was the four-string tenor banjo, and that's an instrument
right.
that just doesn't exist that much anymore.
Well, when I became of age, then I was fascinated by these different sounds. I was picking around on this tenor banjo that he had. It was just, I don't know if it was worth much money, but because it was just, as we moved, it just floated along with the move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would show up in the next house that we lived in, which fortunately we didn't move that much. But I was sitting on the front porch one day picking on this little banjo and not doing anything because I didn't know anything about it. And a neighbor came over and just listened to me picking at it, trying to pick out a recognizable tune. And he said, "Have you ever played guitar?" I said, "I've never touched one. I don't know the first thing about playing a guitar." And he said, "Well, wait a minute." He went over to his house and came back with this this little guitar, which fascinated me that it has six strings. So he let me hold it and pick on it a little bit. And he said, when I went across those strings and that soft sound compared to that tenor banjo that I just beat on, something clicked. Something in my mind said, "Hold it. This is it.
No kidding.
I have to learn to play."
Wow. So how did you, so from that point then, you became fascinated with it. How did you learn? Was it by ear? Was the process by ear?
Well, that Christmas I got a guitar from Santa Claus, but from the Sears and Roebuck.
I was going to say Silvertone, probably, or Supertone.
Silvertone,
yes.
It was listed in the catalog for $14.95. The last time I saw it listed in the catalog is up to like $69.95.
Uh-oh.
Same guitar.
Yeah. So that you got that, and then this is, sounds like a silly question. How did you know how to tune it? These were things that were basic to me when I was trying to learn.
Well, see, that's what my dad played, and so he showed me the fundamentals.
Okay.
And so I had a built-in teacher.
Okay.
I started playing out of this book called Smith's 300 Songs for Guitar and How to Use Them.
Hmm.
And it's, to this day, it's the best instructional book I've ever run across.
Really? Okay.
And so when I was trying to learn to play the basics, my dad would come home from work, and if I had a lag, I'd ask him how this went, and he'd show me, and I was off running.
Hmm.
I didn't have to wait till the next week to go see a music teacher. Because I had one right there when he got off work.
Were you one of those just head in your hands all the time kind of people?
Was I what?
You were one of those people that just had the instrument in your hand like all the waking hours?
And then some, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and just had, all of a sudden something would click and I figured out in my half sleep that what I had been trying to figure out all of a sudden came to me.
Isn't that something?
And like 3 weeks after, Christmas that I got my guitar, I was playing a square dance with my dad and his band.
No kidding.
And I found out one thing, boy, my fingers bled, you know, just raw meat against those wire strings. But I found out if you soaked it in ice water, it would make them numb. So, well, you can go ahead and play. It's a sacrifice when you have to do something now.
Did you ever try soaking them in alum water?
The what?
Alum water. My dad,
My
dad soaked his fingertips in water that had alum in it, and it turned them into like leather on the ends. And that's what he did. Yeah, it just shrunk. I don't know, but it worked. His fingertips were like leather.
I don't know, but that's alum. Yeah.
Don't do it now.
It's a bell.
Yeah, you don't have to do it now, but that's what he used to do back when he was a kid. That's interesting. So the guitar, you're up and running on that in 3 weeks, and then where does the banjo come in? The five string. We know about the tenor, but where does the five string come around?
Just about the time that I started playing guitar and was not good, but good enough that I could entertain a small group of people. Earl Scruggs came on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
And all of a sudden, nobody could understand what he was doing because there had not been an Earl Scruggs type banjo popular on radio or television. When the first time I heard him, this was before television, I just could not believe that he didn't have 12 fingers on each hand.
That's exactly the reaction everybody has.
Yeah, I never heard anything, you know, like that. So immediately I had to, in my mind, I said, come Monday, I'll know how to do this. Well, it's a five-string banjo is a little unique in that it's different, you know, than any other instrument up to that time. It just stood up by itself.
Well, you got the high strings on the top.
The fifth to the rest of the tuning is on top.
Right. So how did you get your hands on one once you figured out you wanted to do it?
Well, there was a lot of swapping going on. There was somebody always bringing up the fact, hey, do you know anybody that wants to buy a good banjo? Well, there wasn't really that many that was out there. They had enough banjos for the players they had. And so we just, by trial and error, a given night on a concert, we would have as much sales going on as we did playing music. Somebody would come in and say, there's a guy has a great banjo. He's going to be here at 10 o'clock and he wants to sell it.
Okay.
Well, everybody would pull their money together and maybe come up with it. And that's how, I can't even remember I got it. I do remember negotiating with two or three different people.
Do you remember what kind it was?
It was a Vega.
Vega, yeah, sure.
Vega.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a five string.
Oh, it was not.
Not initially. It was a plectrum, which is a four string long neck.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't take long to put a fifth string on it, and make it a five string.
Well, did you have to put? If people are just tuning in, we're talking to Roy Clark, and he's just now got his first banjo. How did you put the fifth string peg on there on a four string neck on a plectrum neck?
Well, they even make a key that will fit. Just drill a very small hole.
Okay.
And they have a key that is designed to do that.
Okay,
but make it a five string.
It was above the would have been above the fingerboard though.
Well, you cheated a little bit on it because you could move it counterclockwise.
Okay.
To bring that spindle part up.
Okay.
You know, with the string, then we pick a real tiny little nail and very carefully get and about this time, there's a lot of good luthiers that appeared that was doing conversions.
Okay.
And so he was quite busy, too.
Yeah, okay.
And in fact, I have one left of the hundreds that went through my hands back then, and it still works.
Yeah, all right. So now we have Roy Clark. He's got his guitar. He's to the point where we're playing square dances, and you're learning more. Now you've got a 5-string banjo in your hand. And before I,
oh, yeah.
So how long does, how do you learn? It's a whole different method. It's not flat picking. It's not normal finger picking. How do you get introduced to the 3-finger style?
Well, the guy that actually got me started was Smitty Irvin, who was a cousin of Earl Scruggs.
Oh, okay.
Down in Selby, North Carolina.
Yeah, okay.
And so we run into get to each other playing different concerts around the D.C. area. And it so one thing led into another, and he became my, I started to say unofficial, but my official instructor. And he's the one that I beat out on that that contest night, to where it was ironic that I beat the guy that taught me to play. But then I confessed the real secret. The finals were held on a Sunday night, and it turned terribly cold. Smitty Irvin weighed about 120 pounds, and I weighed at about 290. So he's freezing to death, and I'm just warm as toast. So I have to be honest. You know, like, well, you beat the guy that taught you how to play. It wasn't all that straight down.
That's great. Well, so he teaches you some things. Do you remember, this is a long time ago, do you remember the first tune you felt like you could actually play on a 5-string banjo in Earl style?
That I learned to play?
Yes, sir.
I think Cripple Creek.
There you go. Well, that's everybody starts there because it's a natural.
Yeah, there's a bass, you know, a bass line for all the tunes that you have to know to get into bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to have, there's a repertoire.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Certain amount of, if you can't play this, then you have to come back tomorrow.
That's right. Well, and then later, years and years later, we're going to talk about Hee-Haw, but that became like a central part to one of the regular bits on the Hee-Haw as you would play Cripple Creek.
It certainly did.
Oh, man.
If you hear a Hee-Haw show, you're going to hear Cripple Creek.
And still to this day, Roy, when I hear Cripple Creek, I think back to that setting on stage when everybody's up there picking, and I want to talk about those people in a little bit, but what a memory, what memories those are. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, as you advance on both of those instruments, you won some championships. You won some championships on banjo and guitar, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
I think I was different. Well, I know I was different, but the part of it being that I added a lot of humor, which also adds to the technical part, that if you learn to play a certain degree of being proficient enough, but if you add a little humor, sometimes the audience will go along with you and figure, if he's having such a good time, he must be the best one.
Well, look, let me ask you this. Every time I used to see you do The Great Pretender, you did a little thing there with your eyes and a little sound that you made. And you're playing great and singing, but is that kind of part of that comedy that you would bring to the performance?
It is, and that was one of the most... It got me in and out of a lot of studios that say, well, we don't need another guitar player, but that kid on the doing That Great Pretender... And so I had a great time, and that happened. The way that I did it the last time you heard it,
mm-hmm.
is the way I did it the first night that I attempted it.
What led you to do it? Because I've heard The Great Pretender before that, and I never heard those sounds or those things. What were you doing?
Well, the platters, you know, had the
hit. Yeah.
And it played every intermission we took in the club. It would play on the jukebox. Over and over and over. And finally, people, like I said, used to come by every, like twice a week. And we had the same crowd that knew all the stuff that we did. And they would keep hollering, The Great Pretender. And finally I said, look, there's got to be 4 vocalists up front. They have an orchestra. They had a zimbu player. And I'm up here by myself. And this one night they said, do it, and I did it.
Okay. The same way that I do it now.
Okay.
Just,
oh, my.
I said, it's ridiculous if you think I'm going to be able to copy the platters. So I just did it, and, well, tore the place down, so I kept it in.
Oh, it's a classic. As soon as you mentioned that, it came to my mind right away. And you had such a great... your performance and your comedy was always there. You were always having a good time when anyone ever saw you. But when you mentioned that, I had to think of that song. And I'll tell you this too, Roy. I don't know, as a child growing up in Kentucky, if I would have, were it not for you, I don't know that I ever would have heard, and this is before internet and everything, of course, I don't know that I ever would have heard the tune Malaguena.
Oh, wow. Well, identically, the same thing happened with Malaguena that did with the Great Pretender. Is one night, there was a doctor friend of mine. I was playing a little club down in Safford, Arizona. And he said, play Malaguena. And I went through the same thing with him. I said, I can't play that. It's not something that fits in my bag. And one night they said, play Malaguena. So I did it. The only thing I changed is I did it on a 6-lane electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
When I recorded it, I went in and got a 12-string to make it fuller.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of nerve on my part because I didn't have a 12-string. On the way to the studio in California at Capitol Records, I went in to a music store and rented one for the session. And when I figured out where all the strings went, then I relaxed and tried to play it.
Well, I'm telling you, you exposed, I mean, just that little bit right there, you exposed a lot of people to a classical, really, song that I don't know that I'm telling you just from my, I don't know that I ever would have heard it but for you. So then I hear that, and then I think, keep it in my mind, and then I look for it in records, and what's the origin of that? And that's something that you were able to expose, not only all the great entertainment you did, but you exposed a lot of people to that tune and maybe opened up some other avenues for other people to listen to great music. That was just a great, it was out of the blue, out of the blue. Here's Roy Clark, and he's going to play this classical tune.
Right.
It was brilliant.
You know, that, I didn't even know any of the history of it. I just know that main theme that runs through the entire piece of music, because there's only like 3 or 4 main parts,
mm-hmm.
and then you play around those and fill it out. And so that's what I tried to not imitate, but try to translate to me what I heard them playing.
You know, the first time a lot of the world may have seen you physically might have been on Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
Yes.
Which was not...
Douglas was the greatest thing come out of there.
Well, you know, Platt and Scruggs would show up on there, and you were on there, and people got to see Roy Clark and another. How did you get onto that show? This is always, you know, it was such a small small world. How do you wind up on Beverly Hillbillies at that time?
Well, I'm sure that the similarity of... of the storyline, Paul Henning, the creator of the Beverly Hillbillies, I think he's the one that said, let's get Roy Clark involved in this. So I think Paul is the one that came up with the concept of me being Big Mama Halsey. And but she, Donna Douglas was my first on-screen kiss.
Oh, man, good choice.
Oh, it didn't happen to the better guy.
good choice.
Well, that was so good. But, you know, a lot of people, I think they tie together. They don't know what is the similarity, but not similarity, but the fact that they'll pick something up you did on Beverly Hillbillies thinking it was done on Hee-Haw.
That's right. That's right.
And you can't argue it and say, well, they're two different shows. And they come back and they say, well, you can't tell it from where I'm at.
Well, Hee-Haw, well, I want to talk about that in a second, too. But you had another, you and Buck Owens, I want to talk just a little bit about your relationship with Buck Owens, because it predates Hee-Haw. I mean,
right.
you had some, a little bit, how did you get up with Buck Owens? You did a show before Hee-Haw came around. Then I do want to talk about Hee-Haw.
We did a lot of concerts together, tours, went up through Canada several times, and so we got to know each other, you know, at the disc jockey convention in Nashville, and just, you know, get to know each other a little at a time. Well, when they came out, and John Ellsworth and Frank Pippiot, the ones that came up with the team for Hee-Haw,
mm-hmm.
they had, they always, from day one, had the show was written for two hosts.
Okay.
Two co-hosts. They wanted someone that was familiar to people on television, which was me. I had done most of the television shows that had guests on.
Oh, yeah.
And then they wanted a record seller. One was very hot on all the charts. So they had talked to Buck, and they had come and talked to me. And that's put Buck and I together.
All right, there's part one of Roy Clark. There's a lot more to go. I hope you're enjoying. We fill in the back, and then we're going to bring it right up to current times. But there's Roy Clark. We're just about to get to Hee-Haw. Hang on, because there's some information that's going to come out that I bet you, off the top of your head, you would not have recalled or even knew. It's about another 20-minute segment, which it takes us right up through some things I bet you did not know about.